Thank you very much. And I would like to thank USAID and USDA that I have a chance to talk a little bit here about wheat, since Gebisa couldn't come. I will take this opportunity today and talk about the future of wheat, how to achieve the needed yield raises, which have been mentioned. As you see, wheat is globally the most important food crop and the second most important food crop in developing countries. It's food for about 2.5 billion people. It provides 20% of calories in developing countries. It's the most important protein source and most traded food crop. So if you look at it as a staple, it's together with rice by far the most important staple. However, if you look at in research investments, it's really a kind of orphan crop. Okay. And this year, usually I talk about source of calories, but I also mentioned that that is very often ignored, that wheat is also the most important protein source. And here you can see the countries where wheat provides more than 15% of the protein. And I want to make a point here. Molly has mentioned this morning about really the need for diversifying the diet, and I fully agree with it. And from all the studies we know is that as soon as the real poor have more money, they don't buy more, they buy better and more tasty food. So I think if people are taken out of poverty, they will diversify their diet. I'm very sure on this one. However, until then, since wheat is so widely consumed as food, we also have a major project. We have a major program on enriching wheat for iron and zinc. There are about 2 billion people worldwide deficient for iron and zinc, and we have a major program to enrich wheat with iron and zinc. And until the food, the diet is diversified, I think this is a very sustainable approach. Okay, now what is the problem with wheat production? Here you can see the 5-year moving average global yields in farmers' fields. And you can see that with the beginning of the 90s, there has been really a slowdown, and that is not only observed in wheat, that is also observed in other crops. However, if we extrapolate from here, we know that there is no way that we will meet the demand for wheat and other crops in the future. So we have to think about how we can increase sustainably the productivity, and this is some of the issues I would like to talk during my presentation. But it will not be so easy, because we have a lot of talk about climate change. And here I listed just some of the recent events regarding to climate. In Africa, well, everybody is aware from the news that about the tremendous drought. However, also in Niger, it experiences the worst drought for over 70 years. Your neighboring country, Mexico, had, contrary to global warming, frost in February in the major maize production area and lost more than 4 million tons of maize and another million ton of maize this summer because of early frosts. Then there is also Mexico experiences one of the worst droughts, and I mean this is very similar to what is going on in this part here now. Afghanistan also experiences the worst drought for many, many decades, and just the neighboring country in Pakistan is confronted with flooding. So I think what we learn here, it's not only global warming, it's these weather extremes which cause major problems for food production. And that's why we have to think about in the future not only about cultivars which are adapted to warmer climate, they have been adapted to more extremes. And I want to make a point here, I think, because of Dr. Borlaug's approach over 70 years, 60 years breeding for wheat adaptation, that I think wheat is among the crops which really can cope extremely well with very diversified environments. Some of the lines which were developed by Simit, and go back to Dr. Borlaug, are released, or sister lines, from Morocco up to India, Ethiopia, Egypt. So these are tremendously diverse environments, and so I believe that some of the material or the lines which we have at CIMIT are really well prepared to cope with future problems like this here. Okay, but another issue, if you look at this map here, these are the countries which have the highest wheat consumption, and the countries have somewhere between 35 to 60% of the calories come from wheat. If I read you now a list like, let's say, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, if I would read you this list without wheat here, nobody would think about wheat, right? But everybody would think about some social unrest in these countries. And you can imagine what happens, or what happened, when the wheat price exploded. Because for these people here, it's a real stable. And these are some of the most troubled regions we currently have. And this here is another point to make. If you want to know about, where we will have future problems, if we cannot solve this problem of food prices exploding, going up and down, then you can look at this map here. You can see here that some of the countries, the size of the bubble indicates how much, what percentage of the annual income is spent on food, and the color indicates whether there are problems related to malnutrition. So you can see that, for example, a country like India has a lot of problems with malnutrition, or Pakistan, and also a very high percentage of the income is spent on food. And out there, it's not a fly. In the very, very left of your screen, you see two very small dots. I'm sure you cannot read it. That's the US and Canada. But it basically means you get food nearly for free. That's what it basically means compared to other countries. And that's why when the food prices explode, when the wheat price doubles in the US, that has no impact on the household spending. But if the wheat price explodes or doubles, it has a tremendous impact on people who are depending on it. And that's why they go to the street. Okay, and this is what you can see here, the frequencies of social unrest over the last years. And you can see this was plotted against the food prices. There is a direct linkage between the two things. And that's why it's now on the global leaders' agenda to really look into how to address global food security and how we can step away from these prices which go up and down. Okay, now I come to where I'm more familiar with, which is wheat. Okay, I think it has been already mentioned that Loebel made a study, and it really was quite interesting to see the impact over the last 30 years on global food production from global climate change. And what you can see here on the left, maize, rice, wheat, and soy. And for maize, that was a real surprise, that maize was very sensitive to heat. And that was done together with CIMIT's program, a lot of studies from Africa. That, I think, was really a surprise. For rice, so far, basically, the global warming is good. The production went up, and that has partly to do that rice is a C3 crop, and it was also benefiting from the increased carbon fertilization. For wheat, you can see that it has quite an impact. However, the impact on reducing wheat production was so far smaller, because also wheat is a C3 crop and it benefited from carbon fertilization. Without carbon fertilization, the yield losses in wheat would have been much, much higher. And again, for soy, the impact was relatively minor. So it's really that the two crops so far who suffered most from it was wheat and maize. And there is no indication that will change. Okay, and here are some models from India, the subcontinent, excuse me. I have chosen the subcontinent because also for Feed the Future, this is one of the target regions, and for good reasons. By 2050, every fourth person on Earth will live in this region, every fourth. So if we don't fix the production, sustainable production systems in these areas, I think we will see a storm of unrest which nobody can imagine so far. This is where we are currently today. Blue are the high-yielding irrigated areas. The red, where you have a lot of stress. And this is what is predicted now by 2020, based on the different models. Three models agree on this one. In this case here, the irrigated area will be reduced by 27%. And one model predicted that the irrigated areas is reduced by 38%. That will have major impact on the food production in Southeast Asia. And I mentioned before, these are various models from the literature. If you average out, you can basically say, as a rule of thumb, for every degree Celsius increase temperature, the yield potential of wheat is reduced by 10%. By 2050, we possibly have a 2 degrees increase, 2 degrees Celsius increase. That means we have 20% reduction in yield potential in these areas. There are other areas like in the north, like northern US or Canada, which will benefit, but I talk here about the developing countries. So their current yield potential, if nothing is done, will go down by about 20%. Now think about that we have to increase, in order to keep the prices stable, the production by about 70%. That basically means we have to double the wheat productivity. Okay. This here are the in a nutshell, what the challenges for global wheat production are. Wheat in developing countries is most strongly affected by climate change. For 1 degree Celsius temperature increase reduces yield by 10%. Losses from heat in South Asia are estimated, depending on the model, by 21 to 34% by 2050. That would be about 4 billion losses per annum in 25 and about 10 billion by 2050. The price increase by 2050 for wheat is greater than for any other staple based on model calculations from IFPRI. And the global yield growth increase must change from 1 to 2% in order to keep prices relatively stable. We also have to consider that the long-term production growth is threatened by water and fertilizer. Phosphate, many forget, is basically peaking in the next 20 to 30 years. And finally, the diet will change. Hopefully, the diet will change. It will get more diversified. Also, people have more access. They will possibly eat more meat, which requires more energy. And that means that the 9 billion of today will have, by 2050, a diet of 12 billion people. And that, in reality, means that we have to double our global food production in the next 40 years. In order to address this, CIMIT, as part of the CGIAR, has made a global study. We have developed a strategic alliance for the developing world. And you can see, I mean, we have contacted more than 250 institutions, public, private, universities. If you are interested in wheat, you can download this document from the website, and it provides a lot of information about global food, global wheat production, global wheat breeding in developing and developed countries. Now, yield potential. I fully agree with Molly that yield potential alone is nothing as long as it's not converted into production. But it's also clear that we have to look for yield potential because our experience, at least for wheat, is that with increased yield potential, we increase also the efficiency of the plants in more stressed environments. That's why yield potential, breeding for yield potential, is always has been and will continue to be a tremendous priority at CIMIT. As a matter of fact, we will divide our breeding program and going to establish a breeding program which is solely devoted to raise the yield potential in wheat. Okay, but if we look now, if we really have to raise the productivity by 70%, based on a study from Brinsmann published in 2009, if we go into the different wheat regions of the world, the agroecological attainable yield gap is about 85%. With other words, if everything would be right, done right in today, best varieties, best agronomy practices, the yields could be 85%, the production could be 85% higher. Then Tony Fisher has looked into 20 wheat production zones of the world and calculated that the average yield gap is about 40%. So we can make gains in that area. On a global scale, we have about, based on publications from URCAE, we have losses from diseases, weeds and pests about 28%. And interestingly, that is pretty consistent across developed and developing world. We have post-harvest losses. Really, nobody talks about post-harvest losses in wheat in developing countries. But there are more and more reports, it's extremely important. That's why I put 20%, and maybe that is conservative, but I don't have a publication. We will research this in the near future to get a better hand on this. And finally, breeding physiology. We possibly can increase the yield potential of wheat over the next 20 years by 50%. Okay, now I want to talk about yield potential. What is the bottleneck for yield potential in wheat? If you really look at the photosynthetic capacity, has barely changed since wheat breeding began. We hardly had any impact in that area. And the basic research that substantial improvements in yield are really theoretically possible. Stephen Long has published a paper and has looked into the various aspects of photosynthesis, and he came up that we can possibly between 50 and 80% yield gains can be obtained if the photosynthetic efficiency of wheat is going to be optimized. And then fourthly, we also have to look into C4 crops. Erie has started a project to convert rice into C4. At CIMIT, we're also looking into whether we can also transfer some of the C4 traits into wheat to really affect the photosynthetic efficiency of wheat. Another area which is really unresearched, and I mean this is really surprising, spike photosynthesis. There are spikes may intercept 30% light during the grain fill and contribute substantially to yield. However, so far, hardly any research has been done in this area, and Matthew Reynolds at CIMIT with his colleagues have initiated some studies and found quite significant genetic variability. So this may be also an area which we will explore in the future. So where will the breaking the yield barrier come from in the future? What we do at CIMIT, I mentioned it before, we have established the Wheat Yield Consortium. That brings together the leading research institutes of the world in the area of interest. One of them is photosynthesis. And what we want to do is we want to optimize Rubisco. Rubisco is the most important protein in the photosynthesis. We also have to increase the zinc in wheat. We have another group. And finally, we also have to improve the lodging resistance, because if you increase the yield by 50%, we will have lodging problems. All this goes together, and we have more than 32 partners in this area. And finally, we also certainly have to use the right breeding strategies. We started now in close collaboration with Cornell on genomic selections. We will expand wide crossing, trait-based breeding, and also transgenics. I will come back to this one. The annual budget for this is about 8.5 million. Sounds a lot. On the other side, if you think about what are the consequences if we don't produce enough wheat, that may be more expensive. And finally, also, we are really looking very actively in the public-private sector partnerships, in particular in the area of developing hybrid systems. The expected outputs of it are that over the next 10 to 25 years, the wheat yield will go up by 10 to 25%. We hope to come to an harvest index, which is greater than 0.5. Lodging is unlikely in 90% of the years. Well, if you have very severe storms, it may happen. And we also hope that all these traits are expressed in the different wheat agro ecosystems. And we also believe that there will be tremendously spillover into other areas where the yields are lower. Another area. Okay, that is yield under optimum conditions. But we also have to recognize that water is becoming short. India, 30 million irrigated wells, many stay, start to get dry. The water table in the Punjab is falling more than half a meter. 175 million Indians are fed with grain from overpumping. Well, we see what happens with the economic bubble. This is another bubble. What will happen if they run out of water? And that is predictable. In China, 130 million Chinese are fed with grain from overpumping. What? Where will the water come from? How will India and China make up for the inevitable shortfalls when the aquifers are depleted? And we have other systems. The Ogallala system in the US is also not sustainable. But I mean, you have other water sources. But on the total, water is becoming possibly the driving force for a lot of decisions in the future regarding agricultural production. And wheat will be a very, very important crop in this area. Here you can see orange shows you the response, the water use efficiency of rice. Green is maize, and the purple is wheat. You can see that in the areas where there is little water available, wheat has definitely the highest water use efficiency. And that also means that wheat is likely to push out of the most fertile and irrigated areas in the future in more marginal areas. And then this has again consequences on how we can produce enough wheat. But let me make another point. There is a lot of talks about breeding for drought tolerance. And I'm leading CIMIT's wheat breeding program. But we have to be clear. You need about 1 ton of water per 1 kilo wheat in normal irrigation systems. If you use furrow irrigation, you bring it down to 600 millimeter or 600 kilo. If you go for drip irrigation, you bring it down to 400. The gains from investing in irrigation systems are possibly much, much higher than investing in breeding. So what we need to do, we have to do the engineering right. We have to optimize the irrigation systems. And once that is done, then we will really also see the benefit from the increased drought tolerance in the wheat cultivars. But it has to go together. And the benefits from optimizing irrigation at present to save water are definitely higher than returns from breeding for drought. But we have to do breeding for drought because the irrigation systems are not optimized, and even under irrigated systems, very often wheat is exposed to temporary drought. So we really need to do both together. Now to one area which was a full day devoted to it, but this is just to illustrate how we operate with our partners in the national programs. The Cereal Systems Initiative for South Asia is a program which has been initiated to increase the production over there. There are several components. Agronomy is one of them. Another one is rice, wheat, and maize improvement. And I talk here about how we managed to develop more heat and drought-tolerant cultivars. This here are all the stations where we have now breeding and physiology going on. And what you can see here is, in this table, it's a lot of figures, but the key point here is, again, it proves that temperature is the driving force for yield potential in this part. You can see the highest yield was obtained in Pakistan, Islamabad, and it had by far the lowest average temperature. And the lowest yield are obtained when the temperature is high. So wheat is really extremely sensitive to temperature, and in particular, to high temperature during night. So we're looking now for genetic variability, whether we can find wheat cultivars which are more tolerant to high temperature during the night. But there has been progress made in this part. In this table here, you can see the performance of lines which have been identified in the different countries. And I think this is already evidence that we can increase the yield potential also under warm conditions, and in all these countries there are lines available which over 2 years now have consistently shown yields which are 10% higher than the best checks. Another area, and this is many of you may have heard about UG99. This was a stem rust race which was identified in Uganda in 99. By then about 90% of all wheat varieties around the world were susceptible. Then Dr. Borlaug called the world, and the Borlaug Global Rust Initiative was established, and also donors came forward among USAID, USDA, in particular the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and this project is now managed by the Cornell University. Tremendous progress has been made, and this is why I want to bring this forward here. The fungus was identified, the race, in 1999. In 2005, global action was requested, and within a few years we had developed cultivars. But these cultivars are meaningless as long as the seed doesn't go to farmers. And here we got a project funded by USAID, and for me this is still one of the most successful projects we had over the last years on making impact in a very short period. Okay, these here are the varieties which have been identified through the Durable Rust Resistant Wheat Project. They were resistant, and what you can see is several of them have been released in several countries. Now that is an issue of concern, because of course the resistance is the same, so we have to diversify this much further. And this here is the seed which was produced during this 3-year period. And I think this is quite remarkable, because in many, many countries, seed systems are extremely poor. And through this project, it was possible to multiply the seed even before the release, and at the time of the release, the seed was given to farmers, and it had a real impact now, because in many of the countries, we have between 5 to 10% of the seed is now coming from these cultivars, and if something goes now really wrong, if the UG99 would hit a country, then there would be sufficient seed available of resistant varieties and to go out to the farmers. So I think this was a real success story. Okay, now a last slide of where is the future of wheat in terms of breeding. Germplasm sharing. Sounds trivial, but about 50% of all progress in wheat is coming from germplasm sharing among programs. And I really hope that we can maintain the open exchange of germplasm in the wheat society. Wheat is so far much more open. It's possibly due because there is a lot of public funding in wheat research, but this is paramount. And we also have to combine exotic gene pools. This has to be done at a much larger scale than in the past. And we have to exploit genetic resources better. Simid and Dicaba alone hold about 200,000 wheat accessions in their gene banks, and the Mexican government has given now money, considerable money, about $10 million per year for the next 10 years to Simid to exploit the variability which we have in our gene banks, and this is now a very high priority. All the data will be published, all accessions will be sequenced, and this information is available through the internet. So by the end of these 10 years, we really hope that the genetic variability which we have in our wheat bank, our gene banks, are accessible through the internet. The breeding strategies, conventional breeding, will continue to be a high priority, but also we have to expand double haploids in the public sector. Genomic selection has so far not been applied in the public sector on a large scale, and this is what we will start now. And also hybrid wheats. Hybrid wheats, I think, would have two benefits. A, they have possibly higher yield, but they definitely have higher yield stability and are more stress tolerant. But another effect also would be that the private sector would be interested to make more investments in wheat research. And this is a serious shortcoming for wheat research at present, that the private sector is not investing compared to the importance of wheat. We also have to improve the phenotypic screening. Everybody talks about molecular tools. The big bottleneck and the expensive bottlenecks are now not anymore molecular analysis. It's the phenotyping. And we have to become much better. If we can become to precision phenotyping, then it will be much easier to develop reliable and precise markers. But this phenotyping is possibly one of the biggest bottlenecks over the next 5 to 10 years, really, for to make progress also in the molecular area. Molecular breeding, we have molecular tools, markers, and here, at least in the public sector, the big challenge is that the data need to be analyzed. We can now produce thousands and millions of data points, but they still have to be somehow brought into a format that our human brain can understand and analyze them, so this is a big area. And also transgenics. So far, no transgenic wheat has been released worldwide. There have been quite a few transgenic trials in Europe, but Europe currently is really against transgenics, many other areas also. And I am personally at present a little bit less optimistic than I was 3-4 years ago about when the first wheat variety will be released. China just has turned, also decided that they will stop the release of transgenic wheat for the time being. So I think this is a big issue which needs to be discussed. Transgenics offer tremendous opportunity also for wheat, but currently, at least in Europe and in many countries, the societies are not ready to accept transgenic wheat. And finally, and I insert this because I know that Peter Hobbs will talk in the next speech very much about agronomy. Agronomy is nearly an extinct species as a research. And I'm sorry to say this, but agronomy is the key for sustainable production and to make the productivity gains we need over the next 40 years. And that's why we need much more investments in agronomy research in the future. I always say what we basically do today, we invest in breeding, we develop cultivars which are the Mercedes, and then we put them on unpaved roads. And that is not functioning. So we have to provide them also a good highway where they can produce and achieve the yields which are needed. Now what I wanted to show in this one here, sorry I didn't do, I wanted to show the investments in research and development in developing countries over the last 20 years. It has gone down,